Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Thanks for being with us today. For as long as there have been humans, we've been concerned with what lies beneath. Whether the underworld holds hell or Hades, time capsules or coffins, a refuge from danger or a place to plot in secret, it's a world that captures the imagination. Acclaimed nature writer Robert McFarlane decided to explore these hidden universes for his new book, Underland, A Deep Time Journey. An adventurer himself, Robert chronicles his journeys underground from caving in England to the catacombs of Paris to a glacier in Greenland, and the unnerving realization that climate change is equally concerning down below as it is up here. Author Robert McFarlane joins us now. Welcome to All of It.
Hi.
And we have to just confess something. Okay. There was a huge reunion between you and Clemency Burton Hill. You are her thesis advisor. Is this true?
That is true. I supervised Clemmy at Cambridge many years ago. And here I walk into New York City and I walk into a studio and there she is. So that was lovely to hear her and to see her.
It's a small world up here and down there. That's my segue.
Okay, nicely done.
You write, what I thought would be my least human book has become, to my surprise, my most communal. Why would you think this would be your least human book?
Well, we rarely live underground. It's somewhere people go to retrieve what's precious to them, to store what's valuable to them, to visit the dead in myth and in story, but it's rarely a place that people live. And so I thought I was going down into ice, into soil, into rock, but in fact I found myself descending into some of the oldest stories there are, profoundly human stories. We've been telling ourselves stories about the underworld for as long as we have been human.
I thought about it, and it's funny when I read that, because I think in New York City and probably in London, the underground is where you're the closest to other humans. You're sort of...
That's true.
You're packed together, but I guess in nature it would be the opposite.
Yeah, well, I heard you talking about the Tonys earlier, and I was thinking about Hadestown, which cleaned up, and what somebody made me a playlist for Underland, and that was the first time I came across Hadestown. But here's another wonderful modern reworking mm-hmm. of a very, very old story. The oldest story in written literature is the Epic of Gilgamesh, about 2100 BC in Sumeria. That's an underworld story. One of its variants tells of Enkidu, the servant of Gilgamesh, going down to fetch something precious, getting trapped down there, coming back up with news of Gilgamesh's unborn dead children. It's a beautiful, tender moment, and it speaks across thousands of years. So the Underland's this vastly resonant space. It's also where people are brutally exploited and imprisoned. And so it's full of darkness of two kinds, darkness that illuminates and darkness that hides and traps.
When did you decide, you've written so many other books about other interesting subjects, natural of nature, why did you decide the underworld? When did that come to your consciousness?
No, it's a good guy. The very first book I ever wrote was about climbing mountains.
Yeah.
I am a mountaineer, I have been all my life, so I know that feeling of being drawn up. Why go high? Why get high? But why go low is a stranger question, but an older one as well. We've only been climbing mountains for about 300 years, but we've been going into the darkness to make cave art mm-hmm. for tens of thousands of years. So I grew up in coal mining country. That has something to do with it. I had a doctor for a father who treated coal miners with industrial diseases, silicosis, black lung. And then in 2010, that was the year when, I don't know if you remember, the Deepwater Horizon blowout
sure,
happened.
Sure, of course, yeah, BP.
Eyjafjallajökull, the Icelandic volcano, erupted a few days after Deepwater. The Chilean miners, the 33, they were all trapped that same year, that same summer. That was a year when the underland rose to the surface of global consciousness.
I'm so curious if there's something in history or in mythology that tells us about that year.
Well, I think it's partly that we are unsettling the underworld now.
Oh, for sure, yes.
Yeah, we're drilling down. We've been extracting fossil fuels, our carboniferous era mm-hmm. Vegetation, for example, which are being burnt now. They're melting Pleistocene ice. They're reshaping Anthropocene futures. We are scrambling deep time because of our incredible power as a species.
I have to ask, this was my next question. I want to talk about how the book is structured, but deep time, I thought about that one for a while.
Yeah? Okay, was it a new phrase to you?
It was a new phrase to me, yes. This is all new to me, which has been really exciting.
Good. Right.
You know, in some ways, we read a lot in the show, we see a lot of art and theater, and I thought, this one is really challenging. I've not encountered this before.
Good. I'm really glad to hear that. When you first met that phrase, deep time, which isn't mine, by the way, what did it set off in your mind?
It made me think about another dimension.
Yeah. Okay.
Another dimension and another way, a way to experience time.
Well, that's pretty much it. I mean, this is geological time, which is another dimension. It's not a time frame or depth that we live easily in. We live in minutes and seconds and years and generations, if we're lucky. The Earth lives in eras and epochs and eons, and they're beyond our brain's comprehension. But deep time flows forwards as well as backwards. That's to say, we have deep time futures as well as pasts. And there's this amazing question that Jonas Salk, the immunologist, asks about 30, 40 years ago. He says, are we being good ancestors? And I, when I first met that question, it puzzled me. And then I met it again and it searched me. And that really is the question, the deep time question at the heart of Underland is, are we being good ancestors? And right now the answer is no. not much.
And you can understand it if you've ever been spelunking or been in a cave. Deep time makes more sense.
Yes.
I think you have to actually kind of physically see the striations in the walls and understand this idea of time. Time is history. I don't know.
Well, you're right. I mean, you don't go down very far in terms of space to go back very far in terms of time, and to be surrounded by rock, which, when you look at it in deep time, is a living substance. It moves. Mm-hmm. The Earth has tides. I discovered that limestone is moved by the moon, pulled by the moon. Of course, water has tides, but rock has tides too. And that suddenly, the sense that we live on this restless Earth. That's what deep time thinking brings out for me, a liveliness of the world.
My guest is Robert McFarlane. We're talking about his new book, Underland, A Deep Time Journey. So the book is organized into three parts, seeing, hiding, haunting. Hmm. Just as a writer, why did you organize it this way?
I began with dark matter, began at the birth of the universe. Dark matter is the 27% or so of the universe's mass that is missing. We don't know what it is. We know it's there, but we have no idea what it is because it won't interact with light. Dark matter is predominantly studied underground. Scientists have to go below ground to shut out all the noise of the above ground world. And then it runs all the way through to the nuclear waste storage facilities up in Finland, which are where we're trying to put and keep safe something for tens of thousands of years.
I have been in one of those.
Have you? Where?
I have, in New Mexico.
You've been to WIP, the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant.
I spent a week there.
You spent a week in WIP?
Working on a story for PBS NewsHour. We went all the way down. It was one of the most bizarre. I mean, I have a piece of the salt.
Yes.
That I brought back from my kid. It's a crazy experience because you're all the way underground with all of this low-level nuclear waste. Yeah. And you're thinking, could this work? Would this work? Or are we just passing this along for some other
species
in time? The idea, and you can explain better than I can, about why people believe that if we bury nuclear waste, what will happen to it?
Well, it's a case of keeping it somewhere inert, really. Mm-hmm. The surface world is a volatile world, and we've always stored stuff that we want to keep safe down below because time moves differently down there, and that's pretty much the logic of nuclear waste burial. Dig a big hole in the ground, put it down there, and wait till it stops being problematic.
And that the salt will encapsulate it somehow.
Yes, the halite flows. It has this almost liquid quality, and it slowly will encase this waste and seal it in, this translucent rock salt. And then there are all these questions about how you mark that, the waste. You probably dug into this, right? How do you mark on the surface that there is something down there? How do you mark for 10,000 years ahead or 50,000 years ahead? Do not dig here. And those are deep time questions. And they're questions we are beginning to ask more and more politically, I think, of ourselves. What are we leaving behind us? What is our legacy going to be for 7 generations ahead, 10 generations ahead? These are hard questions, but we have to be asking them.
What about something much more basic, the idea of burial?
Yeah.
Being around forever. What is that human urge to bury our dead?
I think it's a very old one, first of all. There's amazing teams of female archaeologists who are paleoarchaeologists who are beginning to think that we have been burying our dead for hundreds of thousands of years. I mean, as proto-humans. I also think there's something very tender and simple. We love to know where the missing, where the gone are. We'd love to have a place on the surface where we can go to address those who've departed. And there's something, that's what a grave is. It's what a grave is. It's the place on the surface where you can go to speak to the dead.
You also visited the catacombs of Paris.
Yes, one of the biggest burial sites of them all.
And the history of it. Could you explain the history for our listeners?
Yeah, I'll try and do this very quickly. So Paris was built out of its own underworld. The City of Light has an invisible city, particularly in the southern. So there's hundreds of miles of tunnel labyrinth where this beautiful limestone, Lutetian limestone, was quarried out and pulled up to the surface and used to build the city. And so this is a very extensive space. Then the city began to fall into itself. And they thought, right. But they had another problem in the 18th century, which was all the dead of the city were above ground in these cemeteries. And the cemeteries themselves were beginning to collapse into the world of the living. So then in the later 18th century, they came up with the idea, why don't we take the dead and put them down in the quarry voids? And this extraordinary procession took place over years in the 1780s, where the bodies, the bones of millions of Parisian dead were clip-clopped through the streets, in drawn by horse and cart, black cloth over the cart, bells ringing, accompanied by candle-bearing kind of witnesses, and then were taken down under the city. And many of your listeners probably have been to Paris, mm-hmm, will sure. have gone to those small show parts of the catacomb. But if you, I don't know how to put this, break the law, then you can enter the much more extensive labyrinth. And I was down there for 2.5 days.
What was it like to resurface after being underground for 2.5 days?
Wow. It was rebirth. It was the world was wondrous again. And color. Oh, I mean, you've got a very colourful jumper on. That was what the world was like again, having seen browns and greys and darkness for 2.5 days. Green was gorgeous.
My guest is Robert McFarlane. We're talking about his book, Underland, A Deep Time Journey. Some of the descriptions of cave paintings. Hmm. When you traveled to Norway, you talked about the Red Dancers. Yeah. What do we know about these cave paintings and the Red Dancers?
Yeah, well, many people will know the very famous, rightly famous cave art of Chauvet and Lascaux, and where cinema was invented, really, 20,000 years ago. But there's not much in the far north around the Arctic for all sorts of good reasons. The ice was lasted longer up there, fewer people up there, it was rough conditions up there. But there are some in the Arctic sea caves of Norway. And they're quite simple but beautiful figures, red dancing, red leaping figures made from iron oxide, drawn often with fingertip. And I took what turned out to be a surprisingly arduous winter mountaineering journey on my own over the Lofoten Wall. It was like something out of Game of Thrones, as it turned out, down to the uninhabited far side where this huge sea cave overlooks an enormous tidal whirlpool called the Maelstrom. And there in the darkness, the double threshold gets crossed. You cross the cave mouth, and then you cross the second threshold, which is the point where light gives way to dark. And there was where 3,000 or so, 2,500 years ago, we're not quite sure, what we would call Bronze Age people made their own arduous journey to leave this art.
Was there any point during this research where you started to lose your grip a little bit?
Yes, there were a number. In fact, when I finally got to the Red Dancers, I wept. I cried, and I was crying stress out in a very simple way, but it was also a deeply moving encounter across time. And then in the Parisian catacombs, where I was trying to crawl through a tunnel I wasn't expecting that was about 18 inches high, mm-hmm, so tight I had to turn my head sideways because it wouldn't go through upright. And then a train came overhead and began to vibrate the limestone. Yeah, I pretty much lost it there. Claustrophobia is a tough fear, but these were small prices to pay for the revelations.
You also made mention, of course, that we humans aren't the only ones with underground relationships. You have the Wood Wide Web.
Huh. Yes, that's beautifully put. We are not at all the only ones with underground relationships, and trees have them. This, the Wood Wide Web, is again a phrase I wish were mine. If I'd coined deep time and Wood Wide Web, I could retire right now. But yeah, the Wood Wide Web is this, what is also known as the social network of trees, and it's this extraordinary 400+ million-year-old mutualism between fungi and trees. And fungi extend their hyphae, their fingers, effectively underground. And then they interpenetrate with tree roots at a cellular level and form networks of incredible complexity. Plants as well, not just trees. So in Central Park, Central Park will be writhing with the Wood Wide Web. And it allows trees to send resources to one another, carbon basically. The fungi get some carbon out of it because they can't photosynthesize. The trees get minerals out of it that the fungi can acquire from the soil. And the trees also signal to one another. And suddenly, what look like individual trees become intercommunicating forests and networks. And you look at this and suddenly it looks back at you. Western science discovered this pioneering work of Suzanne Simard, among others, about 20 years ago. It's been going on for about 450 million.
You wrote in the book, in our last few minutes, into the underland we have long placed that which we fear and wish to lose and that which we love and wish to save. Mm. What accounts for this paradox?
Because it is a place of safety and a place of disposal, because time flows differently there. And if I came back with one thing from years of traveling underground and reading about the underground, it was actually of an even greater love for the living. And I think deep time, it sharpens our sense of the miracle of now. That is, and darkness also helps you see light better.
The name of the book is Underland, A Deep Time Journey. It's by Robert McFarlane. Robert, thank you so much for joining us on All of It. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on the book as well.
Thanks.
You've been listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. I'll meet you at the top of the hour and then on the other side of the news.